Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. Ben, I agree with you about the conservatorship, but I really don't think you should get Britney Spears tattooed on your neck. Hey, welcome to another episode of Gravity Commons. This is Matt Tebbe, and I'm with Christy Pinley and Ben Starnke. Hello.
Hey, everybody.
Good day.
Ben, it looks like you are have a nosebleed.
Kind of. Yeah, I don't know. I got a little scrape on the bridge of my nose. It's not coming out of my nose, but on the bridge of my nose. And I got a little scrape there, and I keep accidentally,
bumping it.
Yeah. I keep accidentally bumping it. And so anyway,
yeah,
it's neither here nor there, but I have a little blood that I have to staunch. I have to staunch the flow of blood out of my body.
There's people driving listening to this who can't even hear the word blood without.
No, they're about to throw
I'm so
up.
Sorry, everybody.
They're going to pass out.
Actually, cause accidents. We didn't even need to talk about this. I'm on Matt's behalf. I'm so sorry, listener.
I can't see half your face
because that's true. Yeah, I just got a Kleenex.
Listener, I want you to know
I'm busy staunching.
I'm thinking about you as I don't share the story of how I dropped a 25-pound plate on my foot at the gym on Saturday.
You're talking about Ben having a bloody nose, and you're the one who actually needs to go to the doctor.
I don't know. These are trying times, Christy, where
I definitely don't need stitches, but
we've had to replace our furnace, our air conditioner, our roof, a car. What else?
Like you have two teenagers.
A crazy amount of home repairs and huge purchases in the last year. I feel like if I go get an x-ray, I'll need to sort of GoFundMe just to stay alive.
Plus, if you get an x-ray and it's not broken, it's like a weird, oh my gosh, I just spent all that money for nothing.
I know.
Is that how you feel?
That's how I feel. Yes. It's like when I'm tired and I lay down and take a nap and I don't nap. It's like dumb. I could have. Yeah, it just feels dumb. Anyway, Chrissy, you were saying you have a suggestion for us.
Yeah, back to school suggestion.
Oh,
you know,
okay,
back
right.
to school. Like everybody's season. About to start school in the next couple of weeks, and something we do, and actually our church does, is we do a blessing over our kids, and just really ask parents to speak words of blessing over them. What is your hope for your child in the next school year? And then we get the super cheap little keychains that you can write a word on. You kind of see janitors with them a lot where this is the one to the shed or something. Yeah. And it's written on there. Well, anyway, we give one out to everybody and we just ask parents to write a word of something that they'd like to pray a blessing over for their kid for that year. And then they attach it to their kid's backpack or if they're driving. Of course, the driving kids are I'm not putting this on my keychain. But, it's just a reminder to your kid that
really
you care.
Sweet.
So that's my suggestion.
I like it.
That's great.
I like it. My kids go back to school on Wednesday.
Yeah, it's coming.
We've got a fun thing scheduled this afternoon and another fun thing tomorrow. I'm taking Deacon to see a movie and Sharon's taking CC to see a movie. So.
That's fun.
Just the last few days of summer doing something fun. That kind of thing.
Yeah, we did back to school blessings at church this past Sunday.
Oh, nice.
And we gave all the kids a little wooden cross. You can get those pretty cheap.
Yeah.
Just as a something for them to hold. And there was a family in our church that actually posted on our little church group chat that they had, it was really meaningful for their kids and they had done a little craft session where they all sort of took their cross and I guess decorated it, painted it, did things like that.
Cool.
And so yeah, just a little reminder that they're never alone and, a way to
that's
maybe
fun.
Pray with their bodies. So
yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful.
All right.
That's a great suggestion, Christy.
Yeah.
'Tis the season.
Yeah. Well,
back to school.
We should get into our conversation with Janai Alman. Okay.
Sure.
Janai is a Filipina-American writer and artist. She draws from her years in church leadership, as well as her trauma-informed training to write on healing, hope, and the way forward. She received her bachelor's degree in behavioral health science and is currently pursuing a master's in spiritual formation at Northeastern Seminary. She lives in Houston, Texas with her husband, Tyler, and their sons, Quinn and Graham. And today we are talking to her about her new book, Othered, Finding Belonging with the God Who Pursues the Hurt, Harmed, and Marginalized. Hey, Janai, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to start a little bit by getting to know you some. Can you share about yourself, what you spend your time doing, and who you do it all with?
Yeah. I am a born and raised Texan. Grew up in the Southeast Texas area, and I'm still here today, albeit I'm not in my small town anymore. I'm in the Houston area. So, very familiar with hurricanes and all of that fun
stuff.
Power
outages.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, it's raining right now. And so if I blip out on you, I don't know what's happening. But I'm a Houston Texan. I've been here for, you know, all my life. And I spend most of my time, now writing. I'm also in seminary, so a lot of reading and writing, a lot of various writing. And the good thing is I get to do it all from home. I'm a remote student, so I get to tune in for classes. And as of late, I've been doing a lot of podcast interviews, just promoting Othered, my new book, and getting to meet folks from all over the state. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned your book, and the subtitle is Finding Belonging with the God Who Pursues the Hurt, Harmed, and Marginalized. One of the things that is noticeable about your book right away is that this isn't sort of an academic or abstract conversation for you, but it's a deeply personal book. And I wonder if you could share a bit about your experience, right, as a Filipina woman in the U.S. Working at a church, and how that was the primary context where you experienced feeling othered. Can you share a bit about that and those experiences as you wrote this book?
Yeah, I would say the context of othered is the primary context is being othered within my former church. But really, I had been othered in Texas. I'm a Filipina American. My mother immigrated from the Philippines to Texas, of all places, in the 1980s. And I feel like I can say this pretty generously, but Texas tends not to be very charitable toward immigration or immigration policy. And so growing up, I've realized I had to weather a lot of minor and major instances of othering in my childhood. I wouldn't have called it that. I would have just said, you know, people didn't like me. I wasn't popular, and realizing, putting a name to it. And so I didn't grow up in the faith either. And so I eventually came to faith later. I was a 17-year-old, kind of joined like all in, and I experienced that welcome and belonging that I didn't experience for so much of my first 17 years. And so I thought, wow, this is what home feels like. This is what home and belonging feel like. Fast forward a few years later, I think I'm 22. So this is 5 years later, and I'm helping plant a church in the inner city of Houston. This would have been 2009. So if you can kind of get a cultural feel for that moment, just the church planting movement, a particular church planting movement that I was a part of, we were kind of all in, like all gas, no brakes. And I really, I was a part of that church plant before it even had a name, before it had a neighborhood. We were kind of, when it was six people around a table. And so when I talk about my former church and how it was family and it was the chosen family that I had chosen for myself, the family I never had growing up, a family that welcomed me. And then over the course of, I was there for 11 years. Saw a lot of hard things. I say 11 years because in the course of 11 years, you see a lot of hard things, and I still stayed. And I thought, okay, like there's grace and forgiveness and reconciliation. I want to be a part of that. It was the last 3 years where I was on staff, and I kind of, this is really a really poor metaphor, but, and it's overused, but it's how you see the sausage being made and how the product you're given, like behind the scenes, it's actually really messy, really dirty, really yucky. And then you see kind of the performance on Sunday that hides the messy and the ick behind the scenes. And so that was really, it was within that church staff context where I experienced being othered. I use that kind of as a umbrella term. I would say in other ways, I was manipulated, coerced, controlled, forced, and it's so hard to say those words without also talking about the nuances. And so I've used othered kind of as an umbrella term, as I was made to feel less than if I didn't do what the powers in leadership didn't tell me. If I didn't do those things, I would be marginalized.
Yeah. Yeah. So there was an expected norm that you had to comport to, and it sounds like there was some explicitness, but it was much more of an implicit sort of kind of cultural expectation or assumption that you would comport to these ways of being.
We've heard, you know, like the podcast of particular pastors who, and there was some yelling. I did experience some yelling. And I write about that and othered in during a Bible study of all things. I would say that the yelling didn't mark the entirety of my time there. It was more implicit, more covert, which is almost more confusing because it's almost done with a smile on, or as if it's like labeled faithful. So yeah, there was kind of both and, but I would say it was more marked by implicit, and covert than anything else.
Yeah. A couple things before we jump into the meat of your book, Janai. One, Ben, I don't know if you caught that phrase that Janai used about how the sausage is made. Ben and I were a part of a kind of a national organization, discipleship ministry, and people who were closest to the center would talk about how some people couldn't handle working at the central office because they couldn't stand to see how the sausage was made. And on the other side of like experiencing some pretty toxic, abusive stuff there, I came to realize like, but we're not making sausage. Sausage is like grinding up leftover bits and then taking really gross parts of, you know, a pig and making them palatable. But that really is a bad metaphor for what we're supposed to be doing as Christian leaders. And if it is a good metaphor for what we're doing as Christian leaders, maybe we should reassess it. And so like, I don't know, Ben, that struck me as she was talking. And I think one of the things I'm more and more convinced of, and I wonder, Janai, if you have thoughts about this, is that like there are certain ministries or certain people's platforms that I pick up a book and I read a book, right? And if I read a book, I'm like a certain distance from Janai. And then I have Janai on my podcast and I'm maybe a closer distance to Janai. Then maybe my family stays with her family on vacation and I get even closer, you know, or I go to her church where she's leading. And I think that there are lots of Christians that I've benefited from picking up a book and reading. But the closer I get to them, the less benefit I have. And in fact, the more detriment or cost I incur, because really the most benefit is from being the farthest away.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've experienced that, if you have thoughts about that.
Yes, I have experienced that. I have. Yeah, I think in what you're explaining, we experience that with the pulpit too, you know, replace book with pulpit. The closer you are to the person in the pulpit you have a front row seat to see the dissonance and the divide. You see the lack of integrity. And because you're so close to that, with that cognitive dissonance, you are the one in the front row seat trying to do the mental and emotional, and cognitive gymnastics to make that make sense to you so that you feel like you are no longer lacking integrity. But yes, I wrote the book. In my instance, I do hope that people who read the book and then meet me, I tell people, like, if you have something to send me an email, I'm a human being. I'm not popular. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's the benefit of like not being famous is like, if you send me an email, I'll email you back. If you're looking for resources, I'll share whatever article or whatever thing that I'm studying in seminary, if you're trying to make sense of something. And so I hope that I remember telling my agent this, I do have an agent, and I remember telling her, I don't know what my writer's voice is, but I want people to feel like that I'm holding their hand as I'm telling them the story. And if they do meet me in person, I hope that like that sense, I'm not going to probably reach out and hold someone's hand without their consent, but like that there is a compassionate with, this is a word that I've learned from my friend Andy Kolber, compassionate withness, not just witness, but with one another. And so, yes, I kind of in the process of writing this book, I realized this book could just as easily become like a pulpit, or in some ways it is a ministry. Right. How do I not perpetuate the thing that I'm criticizing as I put this work out into the world? And so, I think what you mentioned there is really, really timely, really appropriate. And, I have experienced that. And I think I am starting to develop a greater radar or kind of spidey sense for stuff like that. And maybe not in a judgmental way, just a slowing down, being more mindful, not going, you know, headlong, ride or die with this person. Like I did in my 20s when I planted a church with the church planting movement, I've just learned to be slower, more discerning, give myself space, to help kind of navigate those, that situation.
Yeah.
Janiyah, I think I can, I don't know you. I mean, this is our first time meeting on this podcast, but that withness that you talk about, just for our listeners, like your demeanor demonstrates that in your writing, but also in your person. And I just so appreciate that. I just want to name that and say thank you for that. And I think a lot of it has to do with like love coming out, like oozing out of you in the way that you interact and are compassionate towards people. We talk a lot on this podcast about love. We believe love is central to healing the world, and the lack of understanding and embodiment of love is killing us. And you talk about Hesed in chapter 5 in the context of belonging. I'm wondering if you would just unpack Hesed for a bit and how it relates to the message of your book.
Yeah. I remember, I think I introduced Hesed maybe earlier in a chapter, specifically on the chapter on betrayal and why that has become such a normative part of our story. And I kind of unpack a little bit about what I've learned about betrayal trauma theory, how that's like really a thing. That's the same person, the same academic, Dr. Jennifer Fried, who coined the term DARVO, deny, attack, reverse, victim, offender. She was also the one that kind of pioneered betrayal trauma theory. And so in that context, I realized betrayal is essentially broken Hesed. It is fractured. It means we are no longer attached to, there's some sort of rupture there that desperately needs repair, and we struggle to repair it. And how the idea of Hesed is so important, because I've also talked a little bit about attachment theory or attachment science that was coined by John Bowlby decades ago, and it's kind of evolved from there. But attachment science is essentially how we attach and relate to one another, how we find safety, or in their specific words, security with one another. And I have come to see, kind of from the works of others, I reference Michael Card a lot in my learning of Hesed, but how Hesed really is a God attachment. That is the ultimate secure attachment that we need. and how we see it. We see the fingerprints of Hesed all over the Bible. The Torah starts with Hesed, an act of Hesed, and it ends with an act of Hesed. And how you see the exact same thing in Jesus's ministry. Also, when he starts ministering, he goes to the people in the margins. He expresses that compassionate withness with people. He is endeavoring to securely attach himself to people who don't know what that even is, who know nothing but ostracism or distance, disconnection. And his ministry ends with Hesed. He ascends and he says, "But I'm not leaving you alone. Like there, that withness will remain with you in the spirit that I send to you, that advocate." And so, Christy, I forgot what the main point of your question was. Hesed, I feel like I could get on a soapbox and start talking about Hesed all day long. Remind me what you asked.
I was just asking, like, you know, for you to talk about just how it's interacting with in the context of belonging.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's that attaching, reattaching to one another. But in clinical language, there are unhealthy attachments. There's like enmeshment, which is almost like a intertwined, unhealthy dependence. Like we are to be interdependent, but we're also to be differentiated within our family system. You're allowed to be your own person. Mm-hmm. You don't have to lose yourself and take on the attributes and characteristics of another person in order to belong, which is essentially assimilation and conformity. Many people have experienced that, marginalized folks have experienced that in assimilation. But how Hesed is really, I am with you. I am going to show you loving kindness without any sort of qualification. You do not have to earn this. And really that comes from God's character. This is just who I am. This is just what I'm going to do. There is no other way for God to do that. And how humans, we struggle with that because of our own ruptures and wounds and our own ruptured story. And so, in the context of belonging, I think loving kindness is key. And also acknowledging there are some folks who do not have the same ethic that I do, don't have the same convictions. So I will try to extend them like loving kindness and compassion. I will try to invite them into that and they don't want to be invited. And so I make the decision to say, okay, this doesn't make space for me. And I can't make space for the other person if I'm having to defend myself. And so I can kindly trust that maybe this person isn't the person that I belong with in this moment. And I can trust that someone else can be that person for them. So I see belonging. Oh, it's so much more nuanced now. It's not like a have to. It's an invitation. And I think Hesed is a part of that invitation.
Yeah. That's super wise. Thank you. We'll be right back.
Respero. Hey, we've talked about them before. They're an organization that offers faith-based counselor training. They believe that the aim of counseling is real transformation, not just symptom management or removal. Their counselor training courses equip you to help people to be great lovers of others, to understand why they do what they do, to be emotionally healthy, and to live out their identity as someone deeply loved and delighted in by God. All their training is rooted in the belief that Jesus is a source of life and that we can be a part of his work of healing and restoration.
And for pastors and ministry leaders, their training is a proven way to identify the people in your church who might be gifted for lay counseling, and it can be a powerful way to help make your church into a genuine healing community. They provide all the training and the supervision that allows your leaders to do great work and to free up pastoral staff from needing to do all the pastoral counseling in your church. If you are interested, you can go to respero.org, that's R-E-S-P-E-R-O.org, and click on the counselor training tab.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation.
where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit, Janai, about the relationship of between like belonging with people and, you know, leaving these toxic systems, abusive leadership and relationships, but also like how so many of those are attached to our relationship with God. You know what I mean? And so there's, you know, there is this, it's really difficult for a lot of us. And I, you know, a lot of our listeners have talked with us about this, that it's really difficult to try to leave a toxic system or an abusive relationship, but also not leave God. And so that oftentimes I think people feel like they have to stay in this abusive relationship in order to keep God. And then they're not sure how to relate to God if they leave that system, because it's all been wrapped up, you know, for them for so many years. I wonder if you could just share some, you know, what could you share about what you've learned about leaving those things behind, but not leaving God behind, just to kind of give some hope or some guidance from your experience to our listeners?
Yeah, well, and I'll say toxic, and I know a lot of folks, like in social media, people talk about someone being toxic and just kind of throw it. I literally mean it in the sense of like it's poisonous. Yeah. And so within toxic systems, and within domestic violence can be likened to, I think, what a lot of people experience within the church, in that domestic violence happens within a toxic relationship dynamic. And in that dynamic, everything is enmeshed, meaning intertwined. It's almost like stirred up. You can't sift through it anymore. Yeah. I will say that I left my church, and I still claim and I hold to a relationship with God. Sometimes people ask me how that happened, and I think part of it was my own stubbornness and my own sense of maybe like rebellious, like you don't get to keep my faith. You don't get to hold my faith captive just because you behaved this way. You don't get to do that. I am in part of reclaiming my faith and reclaiming my voice. It was reclaiming my faith and figuring out, okay, what do I believe about God? Because these men who, and it was a male-led only church, which, you know, I respect that structure. I no longer hold to that structure anymore. These men had so much influence over what I believed, my theology, how I, my missiology, my ecclesiology. They had governed so much of that. And so finding God again, or being found by God again, meant I need to figure out a way to find this for myself. And so that I could figure out, what do I believe? Is this a message that I just swallowed wholesale without ever testing it, just because it bought me belonging?
Yeah.
Or was it a message that I really believed? And so I thought, you know, there are things in there that I still believe, and there are things that I think I've outgrown. Mm-hmm. What did I outgrow? And am I allowed to grow? In that context, I was not allowed to grow. There was a certain box, a mold you had to fit. You had to be poured into that mold, and that's the way you stayed forever. And I don't believe that that's the case anymore. I believe that, you know, things are continually being revealed to us. That's like the Hebrew understanding of truth, is like it's a continuing revelation of the truth. And I learned something new in finding a toxic dynamic at my staff, or in my church staff. And so how do I move on for that? One thing that was really helpful is when I returned to the Bible, I couldn't read the Bible for so long. It was, I had to get a new Bible, you know, all the notes and the columns and stuff from sermons. I was like, I need a new one. Mm-hmm. Gave myself permission to get a whole different translation. And that helped. And so I thought like, well, what does God, like what, I looked at it as a story. Yeah. Who are the people who have left? Where, what were they leaving? What were they leaving behind? The Exodus was a huge one. And I realized, wow, you know, Pharaoh thought he was God. And I thought, man, that's a poignant, like a pretty timely metaphor for kind of what I was leaving. I thought I was building the kingdom of God. And I was. It just wasn't the Christian God. It was, I was building pyramids. Wow. Under the premise of like, you know, you're going to get to heaven. And so holding to a relationship with God began with like me doing some hard-headed, stubborn work of yes. What do I believe and what do I see in these stories? Mm-hmm. And I think the cool thing is because I wasn't raised within the church, for some, I know that they are kind of having to deconstruct and detangle so much more from what they understand of the Bible because their childhood was nothing but these Bible stories. Yeah. So in a way, I didn't have to detangle that. I'm only talking about a history from when I was 17. I'm 30, almost 37 now. Mm-hmm. And so that's not nothing. But I know for my husband, he was raised within the church and his religious trauma looks so different from mine because of the stories that are just compounded on the years of childhood that kind of grow into it. He experienced a different dissonance than I did in that these stories that he was taught and he was expecting in adulthood did not come to fruition.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have to detangle that or sift through that, but I really looked to the Bible as a story. I believed God was kind enough to give me time and space to figure it out. So often in the tradition I left, it was like, you know, have a ready answer to fight and debate with everyone all the time so that you can win. And you can always be right. We can, you know, score a point for the team or Texas, you know, we like points and getting the ball down the field or whatever. And I thought, I totally reject that. I think God is kind and compassionate enough with me to give me space and like, let me ask him questions. God, why is this the way that it is?
Yeah.
And I can honestly tell you, I'm looking at journals on my bookshelf right now of like me asking those questions of God. Why is this the way it is?
Yeah.
And so it was just giving myself, it was, if the greatest commandment is to love God and to love your neighbor as yourself in leaving a toxic environment, I learned later that I was not trained in self-compassion. I was not encouraged in self-compassion. Yes. I didn't know how to love myself.
Yes.
Yeah. And because of that, I didn't know how to love my neighbor. I only knew how to argue with my neighbor. Mm-hmm. And so, kind of isolating in what I would call a quote unquote wilderness experience, a liminal space, a liminal season, I got to ask myself those questions and eventually came to the Gospels. And I looked at Jesus's life. I looked at who he moved toward and who he ministered to. Who I looked specifically at, you know, who were the people he sat at tables with and who were the people whose tables he flipped and kind of started naming those things for myself. In trusting, I don't have to have the most perfect interpretation, but if I'm reading this as a kid, this is what a kid would see and asking those questions. So yeah, I will say it did start with a stubborn heart and it was that kind of maybe like the spiciness within me that says, you don't get to hold my faith captive anymore. Yeah. And kind of reclaiming that for myself.
Well, I do trust, I appreciate sharing that, Janai, because I do trust that that will feel empowering to a lot of our listeners, because I think, especially those that grew up in the church, I think that spiciness, you know, probably lives a little bit within each of us.
Yeah.
But often people don't feel permission to pay attention to it because they think it's rebellious. You know, they think it is, they're losing God if they pay attention to it or listen to it in any way. But I really appreciate how you've shared that there is this empowering, you know, attitude about that stubbornness can be helpful to us, that we can say, you know what, you don't get to control my relationship with God. I can leave this system and not leave God because I trust God is close to me and I'm going to figure this out.
Yeah.
And you don't get to determine how that works. So yeah. Thanks.
And eventually over the course of time, it started out as a lonely work.
Yeah.
I have a really great friend and he was formerly a coach. He said, he's written a book and he said, eventually when you do the work and you're kind of faithful to the work, look up and see who's doing the work around you, who's doing something similar to you. Those are your people. And I did find those. So I didn't, it might've started out in isolation.
Yeah.
I don't believe isolation is the way to go forever.
Yeah.
I did eventually find the folks who could help me figure this out in community in the greater aspect or just the greater context of the church.
Yep. Yeah. One of the things you're highlighting, Janai, I want to draw attention to is how, you had this fierce sense of, I'm not going to let people ruin God for me.
Mm.
I'm not going to let harmful, abusive people ruin God for me. One of the things that I've experienced and I've heard other people experience is that, and this relates to like learning to love yourself, is that there is this common warning or fear or concern from many people in the Christian world that if you seek to love yourself, you're going to go off the deep end into some sort of narcissistic, self-focused, prideful, individualistic hellhole. And so often that is coupled with, you know, the Christian call to die to self, so that people inside of these toxic systems learn to mistrust their conscience, deny their desires, and actually gaslight themselves that any focus on what they want or need or think is wrong.
Yeah.
And so I just want to point out that for many, many listeners, and even myself, because I come out of a system somewhat like that, that your willingness to not betray your conscience, to fight and advocate for yourself, for your faith, is I don't know, a challenging example of how to have a healthy self in the midst of an unhealthy system.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's so hard.
Yeah.
I remember, and this is maybe like in the thick of the staff conflict, I can't begin to tell you how many like meetings, you know, reconciliatory meetings or staff audits all of these things, internal staff audits where people were trying to figure out what the crux of the matter was. And I remember in one of them, the negative piece of feedback that I got from after this audit was, you're abrasive and harsh. And I said, I accept that. I understand that that's how people have now perceived me. I didn't come to staff that way. I came very eager to partake. And what I found was a toxic environment. At that time, I was calling it like, this is nuclear and radioactive. And you don't spend years in a radioactive space and come out unchanged. So yes, I accept that I can be abrasive and harsh. I also acknowledge that I'm a woman and I'm kind of advocating for myself to men who, you know, instead of being seen as a strong leader, I'm seen as abrasive and harsh. And so whatever we can, like, I'll accept abrasive and harsh instead of strong. But yeah, you don't come out of a radioactive environment unchanged. And so you're trying to make this an individual issue when I'm arguing that it is a systemic issue.
Yeah.
And this system existed, this staff dynamic. I mean, one of the first staff meetings I had, I came on staff when my pastor was on sabbatical and everyone was saying, oh, just wait, just wait. And I was like, just wait for what? Like, what are you bracing me for? I feel like you're giving me armor that I don't have on yet. And they're like, you need to put this on. And the first staff meeting after his sabbatical, when he came back, was just everyone arguing. And I thought, okay, so whenever I hear the abrasive and harsh 3 years later, I think this pre-existed me. And so you can blame it on me. I think that's what a toxic system does. It's, it finds a scapegoat. And, but I rejected that. I rejected that. And, to find my faith in God again, I dared to believe that what's that scripture in Ephesians, you know, our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against the powers and principalities. So often that's used for spiritual warfare. I like to think that it's about systemic warfare that needs to be waged within the church.
Amen.
Yes. And I try to have compassion for the individuals because I have needed compassion as an individual, and I have less compassion for the system that powerful individuals erect and support by the conformity of others. And so, yeah, I think more of my spiciness is coming out in our interview, and I hope that's okay.
No, I appreciate your honesty. Wonderful. And your vulnerability and sharing, because I think a lot of our listeners are able to relate, unfortunately. You know, like, it's good to hear that you're not alone. Mm. You know, at the end of your book, you explore how Jesus kind of can help move us through and forward. And in your chapter on the Beatitudes is so prophetically powerful. I wonder if you could just share a bit and how you see the Beatitudes helping us and how the church often interprets them wrongly.
Yeah. Yeah. So like I said, when I came to faith at 17, I graduated shortly after, and not only the Beatitudes, but other scriptures, they were hyper individualized. And I remember not even the New Testament, it's Old Testament, even Jeremiah 29:11 being spoken over the senior graduates, almost as if, and I mentioned this in the book, as if it's like a, oh, the places you'll go, but the Jesus version of Dr. Seuss's, oh, the places you'll go. And without like totally removed from the context of like what Jeremiah was speaking to, which was like really horrible context.
Yes.
Right. And I remember it was just a very hyper individualized, like, we are persecuted. We are, or this is how, like, we specifically, without actually looking at the system of like, in our system, who is the most persecuted? In our system, how do we value or devalue those who are meek? And so I began to look at the Beatitudes as, and I'm really drawing heavily from the work of, Kenneth Bailey. I kind of read through his commentary on the Beatitudes and seeing kind of the ancient Near East context in that. And he spoke to, like, you know, blessed, I'm in Texas, bless your heart is like, you know, daily vernacular, bless your heart. And it depends, you have to have like the Texas or the Southern ear to be able to distinguish that as a, oh, you're really being compassionate right now, or you're essentially just telling me and I'm an idiot, and like, there's an idiot, bless your heart. And then there's like, oh, bless your heart, I wish I could help, you know?
Yeah.
But understanding blessing and what blessed is, I think it was Kenneth Bailey who said, you know, who was interpreting, you know, blessedness was not something to earn or attain. And that was a message that I did pick up in some of the, not just in my former church, but really in the church of that I came to faith in. You kind of sense it in different ways, but blessing was something you embodied, something you were just by, I see the Beatitudes as these are the folks that are going against the status quo. These are the folks who are not misusing power. These are the folks who are truly being persecuted, not because, you know, some irate folks will use the word persecution as if like, I'm being persecuted because you're not listening to me. No, I think the most persecuted folks are those who are least able to conform to the powers and principalities of our day, the systems and the injustices. And so, the meek will inherit the earth. It's not the most powerful. Blessed are those who mourn. I have a whole chapter about lament and mourning and how so often in cultures of triumphalism, we marginalize the mourners, because people who mourn and lament, they mourn and lament a system where people are profiting off of another person. In many instances, we tend to think of mourning as only you know, the death of a loved one, but we experience so many other marginalized folks in particular experience so many little deaths throughout loss, just a life of loss. Yeah. And when you're talking about a life of loss and mourning that, you're also mourning the fact that we live in a system that requires these losses so that other people can live in comfort and security at the expense of other people. And so, again, looking at Jesus's life and ministry and kind of seeing the Beatitudes, not in a hyper individualized sense, like I had originally been trained to do, but seeing it in a systemic sense, in a neighborly sense, who is my meek neighbor? Who is my mourning neighbor? It made it so much more beautiful and rich for me. And I think it's just the way of Jesus. The part of me, I don't have to argue for it. I think if people go and read kind of with that neighbor context in mind, they'll see it. But yeah, I think it just makes the church a more rich experience. And ultimately, it ends in the persecution. How I don't think the meek are not mourners. I think in many instances, those populations, those specific groups that God or that Jesus speaks to, they're all overlapped and intertwined with one another. There is a withness between them and they get it. They see. And I think earlier in the book, I talk about how Hagar names God the God who sees. And I think the Beatitudes speaks to is God or Jesus blessing the people who see. Yeah. The people who are like him and who see the injustice in the world like he does. And so, I've just kind of rearranged how I understood these scriptures, and it's made for what I think is a richer faith in my life.
And now a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation.
You know, Ben and I have shared a bit about our journey out of like a toxic religious environment, and we've shared about it maybe on one level publicly, and then we have a private Gravity Commons community that people pay a membership, monthly membership for, and we've shared way more detail there. And I wonder, you know, even as you share about this church plant with some kind of church planting organization that was active in the late aughts and early teens. Let the listener understand. I wonder how do you discern how much to share and how much not to? How do you discern how to name names or not? And the reason I ask is because, you know, a lot of abuse and toxicity happens because there's no accountability. And there's and leaders who are recalcitrant or unrepentant, they are enabled and emboldened by anonymity. So we see this in places like the Southern Baptist Convention where, you know, a pastor gets accused of something and they just move to another church. Or we saw it, you know, decades ago in the Roman Catholic Church where priests who were accused of wrongdoing were just moved to different parishes. And one of the things that survivors tell me is that, like, naming and identifying people who do wrong publicly helps the next survivor not have to be a survivor.
Yeah.
And I struggle with like taking private business public. I struggle with sort of things being gossipy or making, but I just wonder how do you navigate that? And in particular in your story?
Yeah. Well, I will say that the whole journey to a book started, it's so funny. I went on staff with this church. I had a very specific job description that kept changing. And one of those changes was, somebody has to do social media. You have to do social media. And I thought, okay, I will figure out social media for the sake of my job. I figured it out. And so when I left, I had an understanding of social media and I thought they won't let me speak to the members of the church, now. And so I'm going to speak to, I got on social media, not really to build a platform, but I was telling members of my church, ask these questions. This is what happened. And in that instance, I didn't need to name names because they knew who I was talking about for the most part. But even now, in doing this work more generally and broadly, I don't even use fake names. I don't use fake names. I don't even talk about the neighborhood. in which the church is in. I don't even talk about the network that I was a part of, even though I feel like that would maybe get me more attention. I don't do any of that because holding them, I have done everything for years after leaving that staff to hold them accountable. And I realize if this is the path I want to go down, it's going to destroy me. And so what I can do is I took a moment for myself and I hope and trust that people who do have the power to hold folks accountable, hold folks accountable. I realize I don't have that power. I don't even have connections to any sort of, denominational body or anything like that. I have no power to change a system. But I can speak prophetically in the ways in which I'm able. In this day and age, social media was that for me. And even in how I engage in social media now, I've moved away from, I want to empower and love people who feel bludgeoned and broken. And so for them, I don't have to give them, if my audience and my reader or the person that I want to write to, they don't need to know the specific names and so it's really about like who's listening to me and who do I feel free to share with. There are some folks I have shared in private, like these are the names of the folks. I would just caution you, there are people who are in my area of Houston who will say, they will look for a safe church. And I say, that's beyond my scope of being able to provide you that. I can just tell you my experience was oriented here. You can try them out so I don't tell you what to do or don't do. I don't feel like it's my job to convince anyone of anything. I think that's where our respect and honoring of someone else's agency, when you start to try to convince them or debate them, starts to get a little hairy. So my whole ethic and approach is invitational. If you are inviting me to tell my story and to name names, I will tell you my story and name names in the right context. But if it's a defensive conversation, and you guys know, like when once defensiveness starts to enter a conversation, and you can kind of sense that coming off of a person in how they speak, it kind of demolishes any sort of like helpful, mutually beneficial conversation. Once defensiveness enters the conversation, it's like game over. And so I try not to put myself in a place of defensiveness. So a lot of that discernment has to do, I have done a lot of studying and work with my therapist on like nervous system regulation and somatic experiencing. Where am I feeling tension? Do I feel safe? Naming safety for myself, not necessarily generalizing this is an unsafe space, but saying I don't feel safe here. That way other people have the agency to define whether or not they feel safe there. Like respecting the agency of another person is important to me, even if I think they're making the wrong choice. That's almost harder, but
Can I pause there for a second?
Please, yeah.
Yeah, this is a revolutionary idea for most of us who came of age as Christians and as humans in supremacy systems. We don't know how to allow someone else to do something we don't like without taking responsibility for it, controlling it, trying to fix it or change it. And when do I not do that?
Yeah.
Right? When do I not do that? And how do I decide when to oppose somebody's decision via their agency? Or not get my way.
Yeah.
Like that isn't clear to those of us who I think grew up in supremacy systems. And so I just wanted to punctuate what you're saying, because I think the rubric, the grid through which we assess is busted.
Yeah.
It's broken.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's so much. And that's kind of the thing that I'm studying now in seminary and what I hope to study in the future and write on in the future is that I think many of our spiritual formative practices are actually malformative in that many churches, not all, but many churches hijack the nervous system. They intentionally trigger you to get you to emote and to behave in a certain way. And so that's why I have reoriented toward like nervous system regulation work. Like what do I need to feel safe in my body? Because if I can experience internal shalom and peace and calm and wholeness within myself, I have not lost myself in this conversation, then I can extend shalom to another person. I can discern, is sharing the names of folks in alignment with what I want to do? Yeah. I write a rule of life every year. It's usually very similar, if not just a little evolved from the year before. And it's all oriented toward like fostering shalom in the world. If sharing names and naming names to certain people or in certain spaces actually helps foster shalom for those people, those experiences, those relationships, I'll name names. I understand that it's at the detriment to maybe the shalom of the church because I'm not letting them remain anonymous. But I am still fostering shalom. So it's still in alignment and in I'm remaining integral to who I am and what I'm trying to do. But I always try to discern whether or not I'm doing that from a place. Am I in fight or flight energy where I feel like I have to respond or react or just blurt something out in order to discharge this energy? If I am, then I need to take a moment for myself and do the work that my therapist has me doing to discharge that energy, inner shalom again, so that I can be present in the world and actually embody being a compassionate witness to other folks. And so I think it's so nuanced. I think that's why the work of, you know, finding a really great therapist, finding a really great spiritual director, spiritual direction is different in that they are more just personally discernment oriented. They are geared. Many of them are. I'm not going to speak for all of them, but many spiritual directors aren't going to tell you what to think. They want to equip your discernment. And so I think like a lot of that has to do with like your embodied discernment in your nervous system, your sense of safety. Yeah. And so that you don't take agency away from another person. I think that's what happens from our trauma responses is to control a situation, to find stability again, because trauma and trauma responses are so destabilizing. To find stability again, I have to conquer, control, and somehow exert power over you by taking agency away. And I try, because I've named that and I acknowledge that, I try not to do that. And it's tricky work. And that also means that there are certain places and spaces that I don't enter because I won't be able to find an internal sense of shalom.
Yeah. I really, really appreciate you sharing that, Janai. I think that connects a lot of dots for me. And for a lot of our listeners, I think that wonder about, you know, what's the connection between sort of working for justice, advocating for justice, and my own, you know, sense of inner shalom. Because sometimes we can seek that, I think, to the detriment, you know, sometimes like seeking something that looks like inner shalom can be in itself a trauma response, right? Mm-hmm. I don't want to engage, but I love how you've shared that essentially, you know, to Matt's question, like naming names could be a wise and loving thing to do, or it could be something that you're doing out of a trauma response, mm-hmm. right? And discerning the difference is the work, is learning to pay attention to my own inner like being, and when I'm in fight or flight, basically to say, okay, I should not be making decisions right now. Because that, you know, I'm just going to be responding to something that isn't real, that isn't true. Yeah. At least that's not, you know, my decisions in this moment are not going to necessarily lead to shalom for myself and for others. Mm. So anyway, I just really appreciate the way that you've shared that. I think that's really helpful. Thank you. Mm.
Janai, there's so much else to chat about here. I feel like so many of us are in need of older siblings who, like you said earlier, can hold our hands and walk us through treacherous ground that feels like this could be the end of me. And we need people who've walked it and who can reassure us that this actually is a beginning. This won't kill you to face this pain and to face this loss and to face it with God. And so I feel like your book does that. It's there's so many, we didn't even touch upon how you help us approach grief and sadness. And I think I just want to affirm the way that your your story is offered as bread for us to feed and nourish and sustain us through the valley of the shadow of death many of us feel like are walking through. So on behalf of all of us who need a book like this, thank you. Thanks so much for your courage and your faithfulness in writing it.
No, thank you for reading it. Thank you for sharing it with others. It's a vulnerable book. Sometimes I doubt myself and I think, I've shared this with other folks, like, did I just pants myself in my middle school lunchroom and share too much of the story? And yeah. It feels like that. I don't think I did. I think I had an offering and I offered it up, in the ways that I could. And I hope if at anything, people know that in the ways that people have tried to bury you or bury your story, bury your voice, bury your feelings, I hope you are courageous enough to bloom anyway. Yeah. That's what I think the work of, Wendell Berry says, practice resurrection. I think blooming anyway is our resurrection.
Yeah. Yes. The book again is entitled Othered, Finding Belonging with the God Who Pursues the Hurt, Harmed, and Marginalized. Janai, thanks so much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
Okay, I had like an epiphany while we were doing that interview, because she mentioned very quickly that she got a new Bible after she left. Yeah. And I did the same thing. I got a new Bible, a different translation. It's so fascinating. And I wonder if that is common. Like, I just thought that was kind of me. I actually had some weird false guilt about it. but I wonder if other people have that experience. That was fascinating to me.
Yep.
I noticed that as well, that I thought, what a cool, I don't know if she thought about it this way, or you did, Christy, either, but I thought it's a very cool embodied, I think a cool embodied way of distancing yourself maybe from something that, a system that was harmful to you, but it's still a Bible. It's not like she, changed religions or something,
right?
But she still has a Bible, but it's like this new translation represents her new journey, just to say like, okay, I'm leaving this thing behind, but I'm not leaving God behind.
Yep.
What do I need to relearn? What do I need to see again with fresh eyes? And a different translation can really help with that. I tend to pick a new translation every year for myself, just as I go through the next year, just to switch it up, just to keep fresh eyes on the text. So anyway, I thought it was a really cool embodied idea.
Yeah, me too.
She practiced it was fascinating to me, because I think a lot of times we can hear people's stories of leaving a certain denomination or a church, and sometimes their talk is like dripping with bitterness, and hers just wasn't. It was, to me, dripping with wholeness.
Yeah.
Like, she has done so much work, and it's obvious in the way she talks that she really does embody grace and truth, and calibrates those two things together at the same time. Yeah, and I need more examples of that. Cause I tend to see people either dripping with bitterness or totally being fake. And I'm like, nope. Like to really have a real experience and to share that experience in love is helpful to my heart.
Yeah. I think it's important to know too, that I think she has done a lot of work to get to that point.
Yeah.
And that, I would say there's probably a difference between bitterness and the normal anger that will come from being involved in those kinds of situations. I haven't thought about this, necessarily before you said this, Christy. So I don't know if this is true or not. We'll see. but I wonder if bitterness is like anger that has been pushed down or resisted. And it's like the bitterness and the fakeness are kind of one and the same. Hmm. It's like an unprocessed sort of anger that sometimes I've felt this as I think is what I'm trying to say. I've felt that because I don't want to be bitter, I've sometimes not given myself permission to feel angry.
Yeah,
that's fair.
And I'm dealing with that right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's important to feel angry. It's important to, you know, it's important to, I think, to discipline yourself. Like her advice right at the end was really good, I think, in terms of, you know, feel angry, but, you know, understand where the appropriate places are for you to vent that and to express that. But I think the lack of being able to feel that anger and let it sort of metabolize into grief, sadness, I think that is what results in some of that bitterness that you're seeing, Christy. Yeah. And I think allowing yourself to feel the anger, having safe places to express that anger and sort of learn what it means and to metabolize it, I think it's a good metaphor, I think can yield the kind of healthy, yet prophetic, but yet healthy response that I think, you know, we see in Janai. So,
yeah. Yeah. That, that dealing with like sadness well reminds me of the story I heard about a moth that walked into a podiatrist's office. And the podiatrist says, "What's the problem?" And the moth says, "Where do I begin, man? I go to work for Gregory Hilinovich, and all day long I work. Honestly, doc, I don't know what I'm doing anymore. I don't even know if Gregory Hilinovich knows. He only knows that he has power over me, and that seems to bring him happiness, but I don't know. I wake up in a malaise, and I walk here and there." And the podiatrist says, "Oh, yeah." And the moth says, "Yes. At night, sometimes I wake up, and I turn to some old lady in my bed who's on my arm, a lady I once loved. I don't know where to turn. My youngest, Alexandria, she fell to the cold of last year, and the cold took her down like it did many of us, and my other boy. And this one was the hardest pill to swallow, doc. Other boy, Gregarious Olus Popovich, I no longer love him. All I see when I look in his eyes, all I see is the image of the glimpse of the coward I see when I look in the mirror. If only the cowardice wasn't as strong, I could reach up for those pills and end this life of mine." He says, "Sometimes, doc, I feel like a spider, even though I'm a moth. I just barely hang on to my web with an everlasting fire underneath me." And the podiatrist goes, "Moth, you're in trouble, but you should probably see a psychiatrist, not a podiatrist. Why on earth did you come in here?" And the moth says, "Because the light was on."
I had no idea where we were going with that. Audience, I rolled my eyes when he started. I just want you to know that.
Yes. Christy rolled her eyes pretty hard. She knew it was coming.
You did.
That was pretty obvious. That was pretty obvious.
Well, I think we can all learn a lot from that. There we go.
Yeah, don't just walk into any old place with the light on. It might not be helpful for you. I think that's the life lesson here.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right, everybody. Till next week.
Peace.
Good day.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. Also, Ben and I hang out there a lot. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. And we'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.